You're listening to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Hello, everyone. My name is John Palfrey, and on behalf of the Harvard Law School, welcome to the book talk in celebration of Yochai Benkler's brand new exciting book, The Penguin and the Leviathan. I am very glad to welcome you on behalf of multiple institutions that are eagerly hosting this event. One is the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Another is the Harvard Law School Library. Michelle Pierce and others I see here from the library, which has been hosting a series of books for book talk events for the Harvard Law School faculty. And what a wonderful outpouring this is, Yochai. You're somebody who knows how to take hard ideas and put them before us and fill the room at the same time, which is such a wonderful, wonderful trait. Let me give a few quick ministerial points and then quick introduction of Professor Benkler, and I will turn it over. One is this event is not being webcast live at the moment, but it is being recorded. So during the Q&A, should you wish to interact with Professor Benkler, which I suspect you will, please press the button. It will light up and become red, but you will be recorded, just so you know of that. Second, there'll be a reception after this event, which is just outside. We'll take the last question around 7:15 or so, and then we'll move out into the antechamber or whatever that area is out there for further celebration. And last, the Coop is selling books in the back, and I encourage you to buy them because it's a wonderful book, and we all ought to have a copy. And thank you to the Coop for coming. So Yochai Benkler, to this crowd, needs very little, if any, introduction, but I figure I'll embarrass him for a moment anyway. Yochai is the Berkman Professor of Entrepreneurial Legal Studies here at Harvard Law School and a co-director, faculty co-director of the Berkman Center. He is a beloved colleague and an amazing scholar and someone who we love to celebrate and work with in this particular fashion. The book that he's written, The Penguin and the Leviathan, I think is an incredibly important work in lots of ways. It is the culmination of a fair amount of work that he's been doing on the topic of cooperation, a series of rigorous studies and experiments that cross a huge number of different disciplines. This is also still a work in progress. One of the exciting things about this book is that it's almost certainly a marker in time, but not the end of his work on cooperation in ways that I'm excited to learn from and to hear about. Another key point, I think, about this particular book, it builds on, in incredibly interesting ways, the wealth of networks, his magisterial and very academically focused book. I heard somebody walking in earlier, this was one of those overheards as we walked in, who said, you know, the wealth of networks was brilliant, and it kind of helps to have a PhD to get all the way through it and really understand it. The Penguin and the Leviathan is just as brilliant, but you don't need that PhD, and it's completely accessible, which I thought was an amazing compliment. And I think this is true of you, Yochai, and your scholarship, which is you take on the hard issues, you present the most rigorous research, and you reach a very broad swath of people. The Wealth of Networks was a book that won business book awards, as well as being something that is cited consistently as the seminal work in the academic field. I'm totally confident that The Penguin and the Leviathan will have similar effects on our scholarship, but more broadly on society, and it's just a thrill to have you here to talk about it more. So with great thanks, Yochai Benkler.
You wouldn't think that at this point I'd get excited and by talking to a group of friends, but I am. And you're so generous and so wonderful to have made this introduction. And thank you so much to you, to all the staff at the Berkman Center, the library, Amar, thank you, for putting this all together, and to all of you to come and have this conversation about this book. As John said, this is a very different kind of animal from Wealth of Networks in the sense that I very much put an emphasis on trying to get a set of ideas out there in a form that many people who aren't academically, who don't have the patience or the time, could nonetheless access something that is grounded in a lot of serious work. And as I was trying to present today, I wanted to present this book because that's, after all, what I've said. But on the other hand, out there in our squares, a movement is growing that is teaching us all in the making about cooperation, about a set of values that's driving us. So here and there, I'll try to connect things that are in the book and speak to the moment that we're living without lying about what's in the book. And bear with me on that. So this is actually from the introduction. It's not a lie. And it goes roughly like this. And it starts, in some senses, the reason for the book, the reason for why we need this book. So this is October 23rd, 2008, House Committee. We live in a world built around a mistaken model of human motivation. We have four decades of exquisite refinement of systems from our workplaces to our banking systems to our network structures that are all built around this core fundamental error that Alan Greenspan, in a moment of truth, was able to relate to. And that basic error is not that we are sometimes self-interested. That's correct. That basic error is the idea that we can properly model and build our systems on assuming that we'll do well enough in designing our systems if we build them according to a model that assumes that part of rationality is self-interest, and that if we approximate who we are by saying that we are more or less uniformly, more or less self-interested, we won't go too wrong. Whether it's in building structures of control that depend on reward and punishment, whether it's building market systems that depends on getting the incentives right, by which we mean getting the material incentives right, in each of these cases, we've built system across a broad range that depend on this model and that turn out in work throughout multiple fields and multiple areas of practice to simply be wrong. And we stand today at a moment at which, after somewhere between, depending on how you start to count, a literature of 25 or perhaps 15 years across all of these domains, scientific selfishness is retreating, and we need to learn how to adjust our systems design to this new model. A lot of words. Let's try to tell some stories. So one domain in which we recognize this very well is Gary Becker's classic idea from 1968. The way to model crime is to think of it as a payoff structure, right? You've got the benefit of the crime relative to the penalty times the probability of detection. That's deterrence. That's where you get models like a three strikes law. You up the penalty given that there's a budgetary limit on how much enforcement you can do, and you should get more deterrence and less crime. That's one domain. Another domain, incredibly influential paper, the Jensen and Murphy paper on performance pay and top management incentives, right? The idea that essentially the firm, the company, is structured such that every level is going to try to shirk and grab more and put it in its pocket relative to those above. Oliver Williamson is the classic version of this model. But what happens, and so the mid-level managers look at the employees, the upper-level management at the mid-level, and this agency problem is always a problem. What do you do at the very top? Who looks at the top? There you can get the same result by basically paying with stock options. So the shareholders and the CEOs are aligned because they're just trying to improve the performance of the shares. This worked fantastically for the CEOs. This, by the way, is scaled to the 1986 compensation of GM's chair and Toyota's chair. So this is a fantastic theory for the people who have the power to implement it. It turns out in work that quite a few other people, including not least Lucian Bebchuk here, have done to have actually worked pretty poorly for companies, right? So you have relatively high levels of return to share, relatively high levels of tax fraud, relatively low return to shareholders. There's substantial work to suggest that actually what you get is misalignment from this model, but it's a model that has the same view of motivation. Everyone from the top down tries to shirk, but they'll work well if we build the systems, either of punishment or of reward, to get everybody aligned in the same direction. And this is just across the street. So I'm picking up my kids from their music lesson. And as I'm getting into the car, there's a woman with a maybe three-year-old, trying to get the three-year-old, perhaps two just because of the strong will, into the car. And she's saying, OK, get into the car. Get into the car, or that's 5 cents off your allowance. Three, two, one. OK, that's 5 cents. Now get into the car, or it's another 5 cents off your allowance. This model of who we are penetrates everywhere because every reasonably self-respecting educated person has gone through a system where the beauty of the models capable of being written to this simplifying assumption is so enormously persuasive. And yet, we see this across multiple, the intellectual arc moves in multiple areas. So if you look at evolutionary biology, for example, in the 1950s, we have all sorts of models of group selection. Why do starlings rise into the night? These more or less get dismissed as false in the early to mid-60s with the rise of mathematical biology. You move from group selections to selfish gene, then to models of much more direct reciprocity, with the classic being the evolution of cooperation and tit for tat, something that's very easily reducible to pay off to the individual gene as the model. You can translate cooperation into self-interested, and we're safe from that side. We see it in economics. I barely need to say anything, but even there, you see mechanism design and efficiency all built on this same model. In political theory, from down through Olson to Hardin, you see the same model of assuming the inability to come together to a shared model, to a shared set of goals, and instead these models of conflict. And in management science, organizational sociology, from Frederick Taylor, scientific management, and Weber, the model of the organization, and Schumpeter through Williamson that I've just described. That's an evolutionary, that's an intellectual arc. Now, in each of these fields, obviously, although in evolutionary biology a lot less than in others, in each of these fields, there are counter-narratives. But these become the dominant narratives throughout these fields. And yet, she moves. And yet, we live in a world in which persistently we see examples of behaviors that don't fit any of this. Whether it's parents who will work at a Wall Street firm and live in a framework that completely dedicates them to self-interest, telling their kids in the playground that they should share nicely with their toys, because that's the decent thing to do, all the way to models that say nothing will ever be written except for pay. I mean, my favorite story that Terry was just telling me today about using heat in yoga as a potentially copyrighted claim, of all the bizarre ways in which ideology completely denies doctrine in order to achieve a property-like model. And yet she moves. And what we've seen, and part of what I did in the work in Wealth of Networks and over the last longer period, is how much online we've seen easily how we can cooperate. Things that shouldn't have worked, work. And of course, now we've come to a point where it's become a solution space. So whether you're talking about purely distributed systems like free software, like certain kinds of free software, or Wikipedia, or Ushahidi, whether you're talking about traditional NGOs leveraging social production, whether you're talking about small organizations or IBM, big organizations like IBM leveraging free software, the whole notion that you can, as a practical matter, bring large collections of people effectively to cooperate in ways that have outcomes we care about, moved from being bizarre, anarchistic nonsense 12 years ago, trust me, I know, to, hey, let's just do it. Of course, how else would you do it? Very quickly. That's in the practice of life. The theory hasn't necessarily caught up, at least at this basic level of theory. But we do see in each of these disciplines, across these various years, depending on different times, the development of more complex models that allow for cooperation. So in evolutionary biology, the next step from direct reciprocity was indirect reciprocity. What does it mean, indirect reciprocity? I scratch your back today, someone else scratches my back some other day. And if there's enough structure in the population so that it's not completely open for anyone to do anything, it turns out cooperation emerges much more easily than was modeled 30 years ago across a whole set of domains. Whether it's the reemergence of something like group selection in the idea of multi-level selection, and I talk a little bit in the book in one of the chapters about how that's developed, or the application of evolutionary models to cultural practices, so that evolution, when we talk about human beings, begins to be applied more in relationship to culture and breaking down the culture, the nature-nurture debate as one that allows us to model cooperation among human beings. We're seeing tremendous amount of work there, and I'll give you an example in a minute. In economics, the shift to experimental economics and modeling away from self-interest, the development of neuroeconomics or combining game experimental models with neuroscience and showing how people actually respond, not because we like to assume. One of the problems, of course, with economics is you can solve anything if you just assume the reason that I'm doing this is because I want to do it. The problem, of course, is once you actually see that neurologically people actually do get pleasure from cooperating or trusting in a certain way under certain conditions, introducing the assumption into the model becomes less of an act of picking friends from a crowd and more of an act of how do I model these things that I see in the world. It becomes a much more grounded change. We see it in political theory, so Lynn Ostrom's work on the commons in some regard is a model, but obviously there's a lot more in the shift to the possibility of cooperation. And perhaps the earliest set of work on this was in organizational sociology, beginning, I know it's a bad time to talk about Toyota, but Toyota production system and the shift that it introduced into production, the work on networks by multiple sociologists, again showing the possibility of cooperation. The core insight of all of these fields, each, by the way, independently, it's sometimes fascinating to read a paper in two disciplines, and they'll make the same points, and they have long citation lists, and they don't cross-reference each other because they're developing them independently in their own literature and citation practices, is that this initial model of uniform self-interest that is more or less of a good design model is abandoned or at least advanced. And then there's the debate within each of these disciplines. My favorite example, just because it's crisp, is the comparison of these two quotes, and I hope you'll permit me to read. So in 1976, Richard Dawkins, who is a preeminent biologist, I don't need to tell you, the book is more complex than what I'm describing, but nonetheless, this is the zeitgeist that it captured, this quote from the book. Be warned that if you wish, as I do, to build a society in which individuals cooperate generously and unselfishly towards a common good, you can expect little help from biological nature. Let us try to teach generosity and altruism because we are born selfish. Let us understand what our own selfish genes are up to because we may then at least have the chance to upset their designs, something which no other species has ever aspired to do. Not ambiguous. 30 years later, Martin Novak from the program of evolution dynamics just down the street, perhaps the most remarkable aspect of evolution is its ability to generate cooperation in a competitive world. Thus, we might add natural cooperation as a third fundamental principle of evolution beside mutation and natural selection. That's a big shift within a discipline that we understand to be at the very core of science. And it's a shift not because Dawkins was an outlier and Novak is an outlier, but because, as I said, there was a progression of increasing sophistication in seeing just how much cooperation there is relative to the beautiful initial simple model and how much more likely we are to find cooperation occurring in nature, given one of a set of mechanisms that I mentioned before. And what you see is a similar transition in several other disciplines. The thing to remember about experimental economics is that most of the behavioral economics we read publicly and that gets a lot of attention has to do with what are perceived to be deviations from rationality, not having preference orders that are any kind of instability, offer-ask problems. These are irrationalities. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about a particular branch within experimental economics that shows that we systematically behave as though we are not purely self-interested, or not all of us are self-interested, or not all of the time, which is not has nothing to do with rationality and everything to do with what it is that we value. We can rationally pursue non-self-interested goals. That doesn't violate rationality in any way, shape, or form. So the debate within evolution is not a new one. I mean, the classic round is Herbert Spencer's Survival of the Fittest and Social Darwinism versus Kropotkin's Mutual Aid, and the idea that if you actually go to Siberia instead of to other places, you'll find a lot of mutual aid among species. But that, of course, was not what won the day 100 years ago. What won the day was the development of anthropology from Franz Boas and Margaret Mead and on to basically say, no, culture beats nature. But in fact, what we have in the new generation of work in biology is more a revival of the Kropotkin response than a revival of the Boas and Mead approach. That is to say, an approach that, so some of the work, for example, is work that you see up there, some of the images, showing empathy, showing the brain imaging that shows the phenomenon of empathy through essentially one partner's brain lighting up in a way that's almost identical to the way that it's lit up when they themselves are shocked as when they see their partner shocked. There's a physical reaction that isn't there, but other processing of emotional processing areas light up in exactly the same way that they light up in the context of being actually shocked. So I feel your pain turns out to be at least in some sense biologically correct, or at least partly correct. We see the work, for example, on oxytocin, the idea that essentially this is one economic study which basically ran a trust game, which is a variant of an experimental economics game. Side one, the experimenter gives one subject a sum of money. That person can then give another player whom they don't see some portion of that. That other player then gets three times that amount from the experimenter and can do whatever they want. If they're fully trustworthy, if it's a complete relationship of trust, the first party will give everything to the second party. The second party will get it all tripled. That way, the two of them get the most. And then they'll split it equally, and they both are best off. In the classic self-interested model, because the first person can't do anything to make the second person give back anything, they won't give them anything. So in a no-trust model, the first person keeps it all in their pocket. The second person goes home with anything, and the experimenter keeps all the money. One of the interesting things in this particular study is that when a particular chemical called oxytocin is given in nasal spray to the subjects who play number one, they trust a lot more. This turns out to be involved, for example, in the difference between monogamous and polygamous voles of various sorts, and to be involved in all sorts of trust engagements. The point is, you're beginning to see work like Kropotkin's looking at the book, trying to read the book of nature to tell us who we are. And from that, translating to the basic point that we care about trust, we care about fairness, et cetera, that we'll see beyond. Why does this matter? Why does it matter if we build a system that relies on an idea of universal self-interest versus one that says, actually, we're quite different from each other? There's a beautiful experiment by social psychologist Lee Ross and collaborators that does the following. It takes a standard finite prisoner's dilemma. Very short, 7 rounds, not hard for anyone to figure out what the last round, the second, the next to last round, etc. By all predictions, everyone should defect in that prisoner's dilemma and no one should cooperate. Now, there's a lot of work across hundreds of studies showing that that's not how people behave in the lab. That's important. I describe it, but that's not what I care about here. What I care about here is that they took the exact same model of payoff, the exact same game, and they gave it to groups of American students, to group of Israeli fighter pilots, and in each case, they distributed the groups and they said to one group, you're not going to play the Wall Street game. Or they told them, you're not going to play the community game. They asked the commanders of the pilots and the teachers and dorm advisors of the students who would be cooperative and who wouldn't. And those people couldn't really tell who would or wouldn't be predictive. What did predict? When you told people they were playing the community game, 70% opened cooperatively and kept cooperating throughout the 7 rounds. When you told the group that they were playing the Wall Street game, 30% opened cooperatively and declined over the course of the game. Which game, and this is the simplest of interventions, you can lie about this in a particular point, although you can't lie for long enough once people realize in which of the two games it is. But for me, what this captures is that whether we are in a population largely of cooperators or in a population largely of self-interested actors depends on how we build the system they inhabit. Sure, there's a core, even when we say community game, there's a big minority, 30% in this case, who continue to behave as they're self-interested. They present a real challenge for any cooperative system that needs to be dealt with and needs to be understood. And there is a small core, again, in this case, interestingly, 30%, although in many other contexts, it's probably somewhere closer to 20 or fewer percent, who will be cooperators even in a context where they're not expected to be. But there's a big middle who will be one or the other, depending on the context they understand themselves to be. And if that's correct, then changing our systems design approach from one that assumes universal self-interest and designs for those self-interested actors to one that assumes diversity of motivation and tries to make sure that our systems are such that the big 40 or 50% in the middle, treated as a cooperative enterprise, treated as one in which being trustworthy, doing the right thing, being empathetic, experiencing solidarity is the thing I'm supposed to do and the thing that I in fact will do, becomes a critically important design target. And when we think about controlling self-interest, to then not come back and pull the rug out of the cooperative side, not to end up making sure that only a minority end up being cooperative. So that's the reason or the target. So again, in all of these systems we talked about, you see the move from tough on crime to community policing is a model that changes multiple systems. It changes technical systems from walking, from being in a car to walking. Organization, instead of 911, you have monthly community meetings, agenda settings, institutional, having more room for discretion, social, humanization, changing the us-them boundary so that police officers don't only meet perpetrators and victims, but also normal people, changing across all of these systems to community policing. Unfortunately, we don't have very good studies that tell us whether community policing is better or the new big board approaches that were developed in New York are better, but we do know that this has become an A, successful, and B, widely adopted in most communities of any decent size in the U.S., and we see the same thing, obviously, in the stories about Toyota production system and systems and team production that's been adopted very widely, and obviously from Britannica to Wikipedia. We see the fact that we have actual practices that are more cooperative and depend not on reward and punishment and monitoring, but on cooperation and a set of design levers that I want to talk about to elicit internal compliance and intrinsic motivation rather than external control or reward and punishment. That's the primary move. And the point is, this isn't just about online. A big emphasis of this book for me is that we found it out in some sense powerfully online, but that's just because the set of costs associated with coming together and being effective was lower. It's much broader, and it's something that's quite fundamental to everything we see and do. So essentially, we need an integrated approach, technical, organizational, institutional, and social, for cooperative human systems design, and we need to use the best evidence that we have. In this regard, John, I think you're absolutely right that this is the beginning of a project rather than the end, because it's an effort to throw out there, here's the something we need to begin to develop. In that regard, it's probably also somewhat disappointing, right? There's no, here are the 10 steps in which to build the best framework. It's an invitation for a continuing conversation more than anything else. And there's a limit to how much we can get from evolution. It's very fashionable. It's incredibly exciting to talk about neurological studies and to talk about particularly evolution. But it's very hard to actually design systems from these things. We use that more as our modern religion to try to understand who we are by nature than we do to actually design systems. Instead, what we see is a lot of work across many different disciplines that we can think of, or at least one way in which I try to think of this in order to try to explain to us, why at the end of the day isn't it just enough to add money? Okay, so there's all of these complex motivations. Fine. But at the end of the day, if we add some more money, won't people do more of it? And if we put a punishment, won't people do less of it? And if that's true, so okay, so you've got this black box with lots of stuff going on, but at the end of the day, we can keep following the model for which we've had 40 years of evidence that Alan Greenspan was talking about, and things will turn out right. And I think the basic answer to that is what is sometimes called crowding out, motivation crowding out in psychology literature, in some of the economics literature. And one way of thinking of this is just as a set of forces. If you think us as being, in some sense, tied to four engines or four horses or whatever the source of power that you think of. And four is a number that's manageable for me to talk about, not because it's somehow true. But if you think of our material interests as something we really care about, we all know that in some sense we care about material interests. We have to. We have to keep body and soul together if for no other reason. We care about a set of, but it turns out we also care about morality. We also care about doing what we think is right, about being treated fairly and treating others fairly and being in situations that we understand as fair, and that pulls us in a certain direction. We have a variety of emotional needs and affective responses to different situations that pull us in a certain way because they tell us who we are. We have a whole work in sociology on social motivations and connections. Some of it that looks very much like money and the work on social capital that tried to bridge between economics and sociology. Some of it in social network effects. Some of it in questions of group, of solidarity and group response. So the basic question is, if things don't align, how do they work? And the basic model you can think about, the classic model is the question of blood donation and how it plays out. So there's an old debate about the gift from 1970-71 where Richard Titmuss writes about the American and the UK blood donation system. And the basic model, if we try to map it using these four motivations, is that if you have money for donating, then your material interests are strong to donate. Your moral commitments, it's still something good, but perhaps not so powerful. But if you're trying to signal, I'm the kind of person who donates, then it's not as good because you might be doing it for the pay. And if you're trying to tell yourself, who am I? What's my identity? I'm the kind of person who gives blood. Again, it doesn't do the job. So it says, don't donate blood, go do something else. This was a long debate, classic debate. And obviously, if you eliminate the money, then the material interests go towards don't give blood and everything else increases and moves in the other direction. There's a nice study from 2008 in Sweden, which is at the baseline a donation system that basically takes this and says, okay, now we're going to pay you 50 krona to register for this program. What happens? And essentially what happens is basically in the direction that fits motivation crowding out. Interestingly so, it was only statistically significant for women, not for men. And then they said, well, what about if this is a social signal or an emotional signal? What if we let people give the money away? Then it won't affect. And in fact, when you allowed the subjects to give the money they were getting for blood away to a children's health clinic, everything moved back theoretically, and practically it all moved back to where? To where it started before the whole money exchange played out. What does that tell us? It tells us one important thing and one extremely important but frustrating thing. The important thing that it tells us is that we can't just add money or punishment. That motivation crowding out is a real phenomenon. You can map it onto these vectors of how you respond emotionally or socially and the social meaning of the act. But essentially, if you add money, you can suppress an activity more than you actually add from those who care about the material interests. That's important. What's important and frustrating is that the response isn't uniform in the population. You may have gender effects. You may have specific sociological and cultural effects. There are ways of collecting data. There are ways of slowly learning how to design these systems, but it's much harder than coming up with a simple, mathematically tractable model that says, here's my utility function, give me more of it, and I will work, and I don't know what all these things, let me just call it utiles or money, and I'll move forward. That comfort level we should have lost. What's hard about it is, of course, we don't have the full answer beyond that. So if we think about this idea of cooperative human systems, we can think of it in conceptual terms, in design terms, and in terms of politics. Conceptually, it's a move from modeling rationality as universal self-interest, translatable into material concerns, to something that accepts a diversity of motivations and a preponderance of pro-social humanity sensitive to the conditions in which it is. And we need to learn specifically how to break that up and build systems. From a design perspective, it means that we're looking for design that's based on behaviorally realistic, evidence-based design, not on models. Again, it's very easy to just come up with a model where you just add a few things into the utility function and all works well. One of the things that's making the work so slow is that you need evidence that we're comfortable with to be able to begin to shift those arguments in the utility function and to be able to give them weights and maybe measure them. And then there are all the limitations of experiments and how realistic or unrealistic they are, etc. From a political perspective, and this is where we begin to tie to the Occupy movement, I think, quite directly. I think we were all, in some sense, raised on a model, at least in part of our studies, across these 30 or 40 years, to imagine that if we're trying to increase welfare, we need to get the incentives right first, and then we can deal with fairness through taxation and redistribution and all sorts of other things. But first of all, make the pie bigger. You couldn't possibly justify making the pie smaller, and then distribute. And I think one of the things that these, at least at the micro level experimental studies show us, is that you can't actually separate the two. That people care about fairness as an intrinsic part of their motivations, that you can't separate out the incentives from fairness and ethics and empathy and solidarity, even as a matter of how effective and productive people will be, independent of the question of what sort of moral arguments you can make for how the pie needs to be divided. And so bringing that back into the question of how we design our economic system becomes a critical political implication of this work at the much broader level. So I talked to some extent about building blocks, about communication, about framing the situation, about empathy and solidarity, about what's right, fair, and normal, about calculation, about the various social dynamics. These are all things that I try to provide the literature in the book in a fairly accessible way about how we develop each of these as a potential design lever. But it's moving on in time, and I want to get an opportunity for a conversation. So let me just pick out fairness, ride through the other slides very quickly, come to a conclusion, and then if people want to ask about specific things, I'll go back to them in the presentation rather than me continuing to talk. So let me talk about fairness. There's a tremendous amount of work now in experimental economics, more specifically than in others, about the question of fairness. And by this, we should mean essentially three big buckets that describe the word: fairness of outcomes, fairness of intentions, and fairness of processes. One of the things that we find out is that a sense of fairness is culturally contingent and diverse. So what counts as fair in a given context can change in different societies. And there's a beautiful set of studies, particularly in small-scale societies, collaboration between anthropologists and economists, showing that once you move out of market societies, there's quite a diverse set of what counts as a fair outcome, in this case, in ultimatum games and trust games, some of the workhorses of experimental economics. One of the interesting things in those studies is that actually in market societies, a 50-50 division is a reasonable place where people agree on when they don't communicate. Even though, again, in the model, there shouldn't be in these games anything like a fair distribution. But this basic outcome in an ultimatum game of a 50-50 distribution as a major outcome and a 30% and a 30-70 distribution as the minimum before people just completely reject it and walk away, is that it turns out that if you frame it in ways, well, you got lucky, you flipped the coin and that's why you got the money, as opposed to because you're the first subject, people are willing to let things lie where the luck is. Or if you filled out a short test so that somehow you have dessert in the money, then that's fine, you can keep more of it, you don't have to give 50 for me before I blow up this experiment. That's powerful because these are obviously stories we tell ourselves in modern market societies about inequality. Luck of the draw, who I was born to. Dessert, I worked harder. These are the stories we tell ourselves, and they turn out to play out in these experimental settings. There's no single theory of justice. This happens to be a nice study that's got very, very nice studies from the cement industry. This is about cement trucking, and essentially looks at firms across that are regionally connected to each other and are occupying the same market, and in principle should all converge on the same pay scale because labor should in principle be mobile from one to the other. It turns out there's a lot of pay dispersion. Some firms pay the same rate for the same seniority, others have wide disparities. That's on the outcomes, what they actually pay. There's also a big disparity in how the firms say that they pay. Some firms say, oh, we pay for performance. Others say, we pay everyone equally. It turns out that some firms correctly describe what they do. They say pay for performance, and they pay for performance, and pay a little for a lot, for a little performance, or they say pay equally, and they do, in fact, pay equally. But it turns out, oddly enough, none of you will believe, there are firms that don't do what they say they're doing. And they say we pay equally, but if somebody's a hard negotiator, they'll pay them a little bit more, or maybe if they're somehow connected otherwise. Or there are firms that say we pay for performance, but they don't really monitor, and they have very little pay dispersion. They just say it. Well, as it turns out, when you measure, in one case, the accident frequency, and in the other, the out-of-service percentage, that is say real performance measures, you have fewer accidents and fewer out-of-service events if you're coherent. If you say you're equal and you're equal, or if you say you pay for performance and you pay for performance, you do better than if you're misaligned between what you say you're doing and what not. And we can completely see that there are two theories of justice. One is, you worked harder, you should earn more. You performed better. The other is, we're all doing roughly the same work, we should all be paid the same. The coherence between the fairness statement about how we ought to treat each other and be treated and the actual practice turns out to be more important than which of the two actually matters. Again, what that does to a great extent is that because there's no single theory of justice, we have to argue and negotiate. I mean, if you look at the 99% versus 53% debates over the Occupy movement, it's a clear debate about what's the theory of justice that should prevail systemically in the United States. Is it one that has at least some minimal equality so that you don't have all of the benefits going to the 1%? Or is it one that basically said, look, you, all of you who are getting and not paying, you shouldn't be talking, stop whining, right? It's just the people who pay taxes who should matter. It's a different theory of justice, and the critical thing, I think, is that we can't resolve this technocratically. There's no get the efficiency right first, and that's the technocratically correct answer, and that's the level of taxation and transfer, and then let's talk about how we do it. There's no technocratic answer. These are competing theories that in turn are internalized to people's willingness to engage in a system in a way that is intrinsically engaged as opposed to constantly pushing back against it. And that's a debate that is being had politically and over which there's real debate. Then there are intentions. People care about intentions as well as outcomes. If in the same experiments you let people roll a dice or have a computer force them to make a choice about how much they're giving the others, people are much more willing to just let the dice fall where they are than when they think that the other person is treating them unfairly. So much so that there's a classic story about Herschel of Ostropoli, who walks with a friend. He's sort of the classic Eastern Jewish joke character. And he walks down the street with a friend, and they see a cookie. And Herschel picks up the cookie and breaks it in two and gives the small part to his friend. And the friend looks at him and says, Herschel, what are you doing? He said, what do you want? What would you have done if you'd done the same thing? Well, had I picked up the cookie and broken it into a small part and a big part, I would have given you the big part and kept the small part for myself. And Herschel says, so what do you want? Agency and how we treat each other becomes absolutely central to what it is that we care about in fairness, not only in effectiveness. And we care enormously about processes. There's work from criminologists like Tom Tyler about people's willingness to accept once procedural justice is seen as acceptable. I think one of the things that's very harsh to see in today's images is the militarized form of the police intervention vis-a-vis the occupiers. That is a strict projection of repression and an effort to chill the speech in a way that is very powerful, very expressive, and at the same time is considered part of the normal police technocratic work. That's a form of process of enforcement that's very different from what could be. When I was in Israel in the summer during some of the demonstrations, there was a demonstration with about 300,000 people. That is to say, on the order of 5% of the country's population. You could barely see a cop on the street. Where they were there, they were relatively far away in simple uniforms, and that was it. That's a certain image you project to a crowd as opposed to the riot gear. And the response to the degree of acceptance of that policing is commensurate. So let me just finish up. There's lots of other stuff, but let me just finish up with a few points and then open it up. I think what we've been seeing, and part of what I try to describe in this book, is the retreat of scientific selfishness. The retreat of the idea that scientific policymaking pushes us away from what we know and what we've been raised on in terms of a decency towards one another, a sharing and a collaboration. We've seen one decade's worth of actual practices in the networked environment, and increasingly visibly over the last 25 years in various businesses, reviving this sharing nicely idea, the broad pro-social educational bent that we infuse our children with. We're seeing diverse business and social production models begin to challenge the efficiency, efficacy, and growth-oriented effects of scientific selfishness. Essentially, science begins to push back with theoretical, experimental, and observational work. It turns out from all of this that we aren't universally self-interested, that different people respond differently to empathy or solidarity, to ethics and fairness, to material payoffs. Sometimes it's each one of us at different times in different contexts will respond differently to each of these, and I think most of us have that memory within us. At one level, as an academic community, we need a new field of cooperative human systems design that accounts for the diversity of motivation and for the inability to add just money to make things work. But at another level, I think one of the things we need to do to recover from this moment that Greenspan's testimony captures so beautifully is a new view of a shared humanity that we have, that in some sense we've all grown up with and know, perhaps if not all, most. And at the same time, as we grow through our educational system, we're taught in some sense to suppress it, to understand, to be somewhat cynical, to be somewhat cautious, to know that the right scientific, rigorous way to think about it is more in self-interest. And we need to overcome that and regain that capacity, primarily and first and foremost to say, flip a coin, more likely than not, in this case, better than a flip of a coin, the person across from you is somebody with whom you can cooperate. And that's a big fundamental difference from a model that assumes we're all self-interested and need to cabin ourselves in these systems that will force us to work in coordination, if not in genuine cooperation. That's the project of trying to begin to help us leverage from science to a sense of shared humanity.
Yochai, thank you. That was fantastic. And for those who haven't yet read the book, still do, even though you told some of the stories that are in the book and the Greenspan and the Dawkins, those are in there. You left a lot on the table in terms of stories in particular. So anybody watching the video still ought to read the book and anybody here. All right. I can imagine there are lots of hands ready to go up. We'll have Adam. And do you mind please press your button? If you're willing to tell us who you are on the record, we'd love it.
I'm a friend of Yochai's. My name is Shibli Malad. I'm visiting at the law school. Yochai, this is fascinating, and I can't wait to read the book. But let me give you two knee-jerk reactions on the theory behind it. One is that the passage from the domain of science, in particular the issue of biology and evolution, to the social sciences has long been discredited because we are talking about two different things that we cannot extrapolate from to explain society. And the other dimension is that, going back to the Greenspan issue, no doubt there are two aspects of each one of us, and we are being coerced into a design that has been dominantly Leviathanized. But the question is that there is an objective limit to this, and the argument that the reason why people are in the street to criticize the way the banking system has served them so poorly can be responded to by saying, let's have more cooperation, is too simple, because the material interests that the bankers have are not defined by a theory that says you have to follow Leviathan and market, but it's supported by an obvious self-interest that transforms the battle, really, in one which Marx has long underlined as one that cannot be solved that simply by moving from one design to the other.
So Chibli, that's, as always, incisive and hard. The first part easier, I think, than the second. So the first argument you made was this whole sociobiology stuff, who cares, it's old. And it's been discredited. I think that's a description of the state of various disciplines that is true of the early to mid 80s, but is no longer descriptively true in terms of just how much you're seeing more social sciences, economics in particular, trying to move to, and as well as some aspects of anthropology, trying to move to evolutionary modeling and evolutionary models to explain social sciences. So in some sense, the richness and complexity and ability to remain agnostic to the outcome, like economics want, but without assuming universal self-interest, and at the same time a rigorous mathematical modeling, has become extremely attractive to try to model economic and social interactions in evolutionary terms. And so what was in the early 80s resolved seems even in more of the social sciences less resolved. The second point is, and I struggled with this exact problem in writing this chapter of the book and in using some of the materials later on, is that we use science, and particularly evolution, we use evolutionary science as a way to negotiate our conception of, it's a religion. It's a way of understanding the order of the universe and our place in it. So that's why I start by talking about how the discipline has changed, because it's a religious disputation about ourselves in the universe and our place in it. But then say, but it's not where we learn the design levers from. For that, we need to go to the real social sciences. And yet there are components, particularly in the neuroscience work, that do have direct feed-ins, and in the models that transfer to cultural evolution. The second question was, cooperation, sure, but bankers self-select because they care about money. They control this system. It's in their self-interest to keep it as it is. How are you going to change that? There's a real answer, which is, well, that's a lot of work, but that's not an interesting answer. So I'll answer anyway. One of the problems that happens when you have a system that's optimized for money, so that money also becomes the social signal, right? If I make $1,000,000 or $1,000,003, doesn't matter to me on the material interest side, as much as the fact that that person got $1,000,003 means that he's more valued. I want $1,000,004. It becomes the way in which we translate even the social motivations. But it obviously also self-selects for people who are driven by that, the population. There's a lot of people in the population who care about that. So if you're trying to look at interventions, what would happen? So Bruno Frey and Margit Ostolo have a beautiful paper called Why Executives Should Be Paid Like Bureaucrats. That is to say, what would happen if you externally, politically, forced payments to be more bureaucratic and much more related to worker pay? So, you know, the differences between when Jensen and Murphy, in the 80s, Japanese ratios of CEO pay to worker pay was about 1 to 26. The US, if I remember this off the top of my head, was around 1 to 40, 1 to 50. Europe was somewhere in the middle. After the Jensen and Murphy piece gave rise to this, sure, you should pay in stock options, the US went to 1 to 500, white to 600, without Japan and Europe following to the same extent at all. So you got a different set of people. So that's an intervention that basically says, don't pull these people. Do you or don't you introduce ethics into and professional ethics into business? We, as lawyers, have professional ethics all the time. We know their limitations, but we at least have something to touch against. When we try to train people for mediation, so in the communication part, I talk about some of the handbooks and differences between litigation and mediation. We try to teach different values to get people not to my side wins, but let's figure out where. So you train people differently. That's a long-term intervention. Is it hard? Sure, it's hard. When you talk to some of the businesses, I don't know, like IBM, who are trying to interface with the networked environment and trying to connect, say, for example, open source projects. One of the problems is the kind of person who can be an effective participant in open source development for IBM is a very different kind of person from the person who can weave their way up in a bureaucratic hierarchy. An organization has to begin to learn who the right people are for itself. So if you're lucky and you have an organization, somebody relatively at the top who understands that, they begin to find these ways and develop processes to identify different talent that responds differently. Say, valuing the fact that people go out and were part of the Peace Corps as opposed to ran straight from business school. Those are the kinds of interventions. They're not a from today for to tomorrow, but I think that they do tie to the specific sources of insight, as opposed to just waving my arms and saying, do these things, which is really the effort of trying to translate what we have from the evidence, which is incomplete, into a set of at least first-line interventions, which are also incomplete.
Two obviously great questions with lots to respond. Sasha.
So just to push you a little bit further on this, I mean, I love this work, as you know. But so today, I'm a new professor at MIT, and today my department was visited by someone from the licensing office. So they gave us a very nice PowerPoint about the model through which any ideas that we develop can easily be copyrighted and patented and so on. And when I asked him about alternative licensing models, he did have an answer, which was that, yes, we certainly do that. There's the MIT license. We have open licensing. But it was really a yes, but answer. And when I tried to push him a little bit further and talk about, well, it would be interesting, since there is such a broad transformation in so many domains of knowledge production and invention, to actually have resources in your office devoted to helping people learn about these other modes. His answer was, well, you know, talk to the top of the hierarchy. You know, my office does what it does. And so I guess the question is, how do we, sort of normalize or infiltrate or generate spaces where these forms or modes of distributed and shared and networked production can be systematized across the whole educational system, especially in a context where those who are responsible for doing that work are responding to the imperatives given to them by those who were very good at climbing to the top of the hierarchy based on the previous model?
So I think that's, again, a fascinating and very real-world problem. And in this room, there are many people who are working on it in different ways. As with any other context, to some extent you fight, to some extent you argue, and sometimes you even persuade. The question of university licensing is a combination of all of these. So if you look, for example, at the at university. At university open access publication. So, John, you're part of this major project here. Stuart Schieber, who's one of the directors of the Berkman Center and at the Computer Science Department, Bob Darton, the library, pushes forward in the faculty. We use our power in the hierarchy of universities to raise a flag and say, we care and we can do it this way. That is to say, we can all commit in these faculties and this law school as well to distribute our work freely. And that allows somebody else to come and say, hey, look at what they did. It's feasible. I think there was a lot of this business of people doing their own releasing and then getting other people. You know, after I released Wealth of Networks freely on the web the first day that it came out, and that was the first university press sort of book type thing that came out, I got emails from all sorts of people who were trying to negotiate. What did you do? What did you say? Well, get another offer. Start getting them to feel like they want to and negotiate hard and ultimately point to see what happened with the sales of that thing or what happened with the sales of the other. And then you have to, and then there's politics. So if you've got the student organization, University Allied for Essential Medicines, it starts out with patenting for essential medicines and becomes more generally a student organization that's trying to pull universities in. There's no question, universities should in principle be easier, because in some sense, our business model does not depend on this thing in the least. Though there are people for whom their metrics of success is succeeding. That's their job, following from a statute that says, yeah.
Just really quickly on that, one of his slides showed that MIT sort of held up as, you know, one of the most successful examples of the licensing. 2 to 3% of the income of the university, you know, came from this licensing.
Yeah. So this is a paper that when I tried to measure there about 10 years ago when I did a paper on this, you know, it ranged from 0.5% in University of California to that's all. It's not a rounding error, but for many universities it is. For many universities, actually, the cost of the office doesn't cover the revenues, but it's the thing to do. And that's part of what I'm trying to do with this book, is get people to stop thinking that it's the thing to do because science tells us so. No, science doesn't tell us so.
I will note that both your book at Yale University Press that was open and Jonathan Zittrin's, who was in the back, I saw him before.
He got wise.
He did. The Future of the Internet, both were available open access and sold for academic books were blockbusters, right? I mean, they're really, that is two amazing data points, both from Yale University Press, notably. How about someone in the back? Yes, sir, right in front of the microphone, in the camera.
Hi. Yochai, I'm completely convinced. A Nobel laureate in economics once said it's safe to assume that people are self-interest with guile. And clearly science does not support this. So Oliver Williamson may be a Nobel laureate in economics, but he was probably wrong on this. What I hope to get from you is, what are the burning policy implications of this shift in the way we view the world? So if you had a magic wand and you could just fly around and make people see the light, make people understand that we should conceptualize humans not as self-interest with guile, but as cooperators, where do you think we would get the biggest bang for the buck? Where should we start? Should we make Congress more cooperative? Should we change the patent system? Should we change the way organizations work? Who should pay attention to that? Who should be the foremost people that should pay attention to these findings?
So, thanks. That's a real and hard question. In the interest of full disclosure, I don't answer it in this book. Here and there, from the examples, it begins to point in the direction. I think, for example, that a more formal assessment of the relative success of community policing and big board approaches is an important intervention in the day-to-day control of large populations and the degree to which they are or are not free. That's a level. Again, look at the squares, look at the parks. The basic question of whether or not we continue to build a society that is built on maximizing total growth, or a society that trades off some form of total growth with a more equitable distribution of outcomes, with some minimal set of capabilities. Am I able to back out of this anything like whether or not the model is living wage or a certain level of educational tax subsidies or something else? I can't. What I can and what I have tried to say is that these kinds of interventions, and purposefully I'm not going to patent, I'm not going to open access, I'm not going to networks, although there I am much more competent to speak specifically, because I want to make it very clear that the point is much broader and deeper, and that I think that the, we might call it Washington consensus, if that's what we want to call it, the particular model that has typified essentially the last 20 years, since the 70s, of deregulation, is one that is built on an erroneous model of interest that has contributed, at least to some extent, to this pattern of internal ratcheting up of the degree to which people who are self-interested are running certain organizations and systems, leading to their failures. And that's those are the biggest policy questions, but in some sense they're also the most distant, because the work that I use is all done at the micro level, right? None of this work says an organization isn't self-interested. I don't know anything about that, because we don't have work of this kind. The work is all done at the micro. In some senses, the book plays the role of who we are and what is our place in nature to plug into those debates rather than the immediate translations. There are immediate translations. So if you talk about copyright in music, the idea that musicians really need these payoffs is simply false, descriptively. We all know it from actual observations of the market. The idea that the only way you'll get people to pay for their musician, to support their musicians, is if you force them criminally. That's false. We have empirical data for that. That's something that I do talk about a little bit in the book. So there are places where the relationship between the micro motivations and the institutional intervention are very close and are relatively easy to make. And there are places that are much more fundamental. And I try in the book to play a little bit between both of those levels, but not do much of the translation.
I think, Yochai, you sell yourself a little short. Chapter 10 on how to raise a penguin seems to be, in fact, maybe some of that description.
Although that's more about organizational structures design, and processes, yep, than it is about policy questions, which is what Shane was asking about.
That sounds right. So we've had a couple questions or comments that all seem pretty friendly. and agreeable. I wonder, is there anyone who really, kind of in a fundamental way, disagrees, who wants to crack it? And then there'll be one final question. Yes, sir, you're on with the disagreement.
Bob Zastro. I worked in corporate America for most of my life and also as a Federal Cross prosecutor. One comment. I've looked at pay inequality in Japan for a while and in the United States. And if you look at that in relation to corporate compliance, the last thing that I think makes a difference is the degree of gap between the manager and the worker. If, for example, you look at antitrust compliance in Japan vis-a-vis America, it is much higher in the United States because the deterrent regimes are very, very effective and they're very well enforced. If you look at America, for example, 50 or 60 years ago, when my granddad ran Railway Express, and I think he made $25,000 a year or something like that, and compared just to a level of compliance on things we all care about, which are civil rights, you know, environmental protection, antitrust, I wouldn't say disclosure to consumers, but in a whole set of things, compliance is much better in the current view, and it's much better in America vis-a-vis many other countries. Price fixing cartels, for example, don't have meetings in America because they know the FBI may be knocking at the door. So do you have any other prescriptions for reforming corporate America in areas where we all are concerned about other than just compressing salaries?
So several things. That's a rich and good set of questions. Several things. The first is, once you're talking about the behavior of a corporation or organization, we don't have the same kind of data on what happens within a corporate decision making. When people see their role as agents of someone else, so they're not acting for themselves, you begin to have conflicts about the ethics of the role and the ethics of the individual. Sometimes doing something that's skirting the edge for the good of my shareholders, my community, my whatever, becomes morally acceptable given the framework of what my role is, my fiduciary duty, etc. And so then you need the external enforcement. No, I'll actually do them poorly. So it's very hard for me to say at the level of corporate enforcement what to do, except to then begin to look at, are you talking about individual? Are you talking about corporate incentives? Are you able to essentially change the perception of these corporate managers about what they're supposed to do?
I think a lot of people would agree that the one thing that really does make a huge difference is jail time for the executive and the probability of getting caught, which was a huge problem in our securities debacle. And if you compare the record of securities enforcement and antitrust enforcement, for example, in the United States, you'll see that it is relatively certain jail time, if you're convicted, is a huge deterrent and is very effective.
How would you then explain the findings, for example, that pay disparity or pay ratio predicts probability of tax fraud, where you keep the baseline? So this is one of the early 2000s studies that tries to test Jensen and Murphy. Same baseline enforcement on the background, but a real contributor is the extent to which you've got stock options, or not the pay ratio, but whether or not you have stock options predicts tax fraud outcomes.
I really can't. I don't know. I'm just coming with my examples and the ones that I'm familiar with. I would urge you, though, really to take a look at the record of antitrust enforcement over time, mm-hmm. and also transnationally, because I think that would be a counterexample.
So my point, though, is that there's no question that adding money or adding punishment has effects on behavior. The question in each context, and this is why I was trying to be very careful about talking about specific context and specific evidence based on what we can actually observe and measure, is whether or not the intervention at the margin of enforcement has effects that are beneficial or not beneficial on the behavior relative to interventions that are more cooperative in nature. Would that be education? Would that be limiting PAPE? Those are the levers with which, at the moment, we have a little bit of data, but that's all we have at the moment.
Fair point.
Yokai, are you ready for one more final question?
Sure.
Please.
Thank you. My name is Emily Dexter, and if a principal of a high school came to you, and the high school served a very, you know, multi-ethnic, multi-income, diverse population, so there are a lot of different interests and a lot of different people trying to get different things out of their educational system, and this was sort of your typical high school with different types of courses and teachers and all those sorts of things, what kinds of ideas would you want to see that, how could your ideas influence a secondary school, for example?
So I'm very fortunate to be the son of someone who founded three schools in Israel over the course of her life. Actually, no, it's two schools and one volunteer organization. So dealing with exactly this question in populations of extremely poor parts of the city, as well as in a magnet school that brought people from all over the city. And in that regard, the lessons are relatively straightforward, which is to say, higher degrees of autonomy, higher degrees of trust, structure with clearly set goals, but at the same time, a good bit of teamwork and cooperation between the students, a less hierarchical and less distant relationship between teachers and students. High-stakes testing doesn't seem to me to have been particularly effective on the side of motivating teachers. At least that's what I think we're beginning to see here in the results here. So in that regard, because you're talking, again, at the micro level of what works with kids and getting them to want to learn, to want to cooperate, to want to behave, that's the set of solutions. How easy it is when you're talking about a population that comes from a very low-trust environment, that has a long personal history of being treated aggressively, is a very different question. But I think in that domain, the application is much more direct, and there's literature within the education literature that talks about somewhat more open with greater trust models and the performance effects relative to much more rigid architectures. And that's, in some sense, some of the primary materials that I see rather than what I would learn from rather than what I would try to teach.
Yokai, this was a great gift. Thank you so much. This was a wonderful evening.
Thank you.